everybody, and welcome to the Wolverine 24/7 podcast, your audio source for all things Michigan football, basketball, recruiting, and more. For all of our stories, we are all writers, of course. Check us out at michigan.247sports.com or themichiganinsider.com, however you want to get there. I'm your host, Zach Shaw. Usually we have Steve Lorenz on the phone lines. He is on vacation, so we're bringing back a former member of the Wolverine 24/7 podcast who is now doing his thing over at wolverineswire.com, a branch of the USA Today Sports Network. Isaiah Hull in the building, back on the podcast. Welcome back, Isaiah.
Thanks. I think you forgot to mention arguably the most important member during my tenure on the Wolverine 24/7 podcast. I brought a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
and
things
were really
and stuff.
Excited about that stuff. Yeah, and we always talk about that stuff at least for a minute. So that was, you know, that was bar none, I think, people's favorite part, at least during the times in which I was talking.
When you were talking, there is nothing anyone wanted to listen to more than the things and stuff that you brought to the podcast. But anyway, you're back. Yeah, you're grinding over at Wolverine's Wire, pumping out story upon story for, similar to 24/7. So in recruiting and football, and we got some questions that we're going to answer and we're going to tackle later. But the one topic, by the way, this is like the slowest news week that I can remember. Just thinking like trying to think like, watch list is like the only thing that's newsworthy that has happened at all. So anyway, one thing though that you guys have been putting together over at Wolverine's Wire, you and Evan Petzold, is the barbecue at the Big House visitor list. And I guess I'll let you opine on this, but it seems like that one giant visit weekend they had in June might dwarf this as far as commitments coming out of it. But this is another, it's a big time opportunity. It's always been a hit with the players, hit with the families. It's a good time. Ann Arbor is pretty darn gorgeous in July. And I guess so, looking at it broadly, how significant is the barbecue at the Big House going to be this year?
Well, it certainly lacks the star power of some of the previous years because, you look back to 2 years ago, you had guys like Najee Harris there, and you're hanging on, the internet, looking on Twitter for refreshes just to get a glimpse of, how things are going with like Najee or just some of the other five-star type guys they had there. You don't have that this year compared to some of the previous years. I'd say the biggest names are still some, uncommitted guys. I shouldn't say uncommitted, but tentative guys that haven't fully said, yes, I'm 100% there. A guy like Isaiah Foskey, the four-star out of Concord De La Salle in California, he's probably the biggest name that's potentially on the list as far as that's concerned. But I think it's pretty solid, just more looking towards the 2020 type guys that are going to be there. Khalil Mullings from Milton Academy in Boston. That's a huge name that you really want to have, have there. They got the Trinity Catholic four-star running back Mookie Cooper that's confirmed to come. Oklahoma four-star cornerback Miles Slusher. So, there are guys that I'd say more looking forward, and that's, I think, where Michigan's gotten a little bit better, is not just focusing strictly on the current year. Because in the last couple of years, especially before the early signing period, that's really what I think they kind of did more. While Friday Night Lights down in Columbus, like that always seems to produce an equal amount of 2019 or, this year's targets and next year's targets, rather. And I think they're just doing a really good job of kind of looking a bit more forward. So you don't necessarily have some of those big names. I know Daxton Hill was tentatively going to come to this one. He ended up pushing that back to just do an official visit during the season. I don't think that's a big deal at all, by the way. But it's, it just kind of allows them to be able to focus on, some guys that obviously they might not be as top tier as the Zach Harrisons, mm-hmm. and King Ojabo and the Cosmos and, Lewis Scenes, signs. I don't ever know how to say his name, by the way. I've talked to him. That's bad.
I can't remember. But, I thought it was Cine. Am I wrong?
Maybe it's Cine.
Oh, well.
I don't know. I should have asked him, honestly. But, you know, you had all those guys back then, you know, a month ago, month plus ago at this point. So, to me, it doesn't necessarily – they don't necessarily need to get all of those big guys. I think it's a little bit more important when you are trying to lure some of your current year targets to have other, you know, big-time current year targets and commits there with you. And I think that's, you know, a month and a half ago, it was perfect because they had Zach Harrison there, and he's spending time with, you know, Quidipe and Luigi Villain currently on the team, and he's got Chris Hinton in his ear, and he has Mozzie Smith there with him who committed, you know, 2 days later. It's important to have that. Mm-hmm. So that's why I feel like they don't necessarily need that for this. This is going to be a lot bigger. They can, you know, they don't have to hone in their focus on one or two guys because you've got a broad focus of guys that are going to be there that aren't necessarily all their top targets for this year. And then you've got a bunch of guys that they can start getting to know for next year. So
right. Yeah.
Whereas last year they were really focused on Quavarez, Crouch, and JT Daniels. Granted, Daniels was considered a 2019 guy at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now they don't necessarily have those guys where they're just like going to be sitting there being like, oh man, really, really need to spend all of our time working on this one dude. Now they can spend a lot more time just essentially, you know, espousing the benefits of University of Michigan to a wider swath.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think this is something that goes with kind of what we saw this summer. And I know Steve has opined in the past that this new official visit ability to do it in the spring or the summer might ultimately hurt Northern teams, but it seems like the Big Ten schools, at least the ones who tend to be high-profile recruiting schools, it seems like they have taken this new rule change as a effort to speed up their timeline. Michigan already has a better recruiting score than it did in the 2018 class. You know, they already have 19 commits, and we'll talk about this from a question that we have later on, but, you know, creating spots for that many more players, you know, it'll happen, but it will be a significant amount of turnover. I mean, they're already technically, you know, oversigned, so to speak, even though it's a long way between here and there, and there'll be tons of attrition. But you know, it's one of those things where the timeline is sped up. That said, in these next, you know, because maybe it's not through the barbecue, because as you said, they have a unique opportunity where it's less of a, you know, official visit kind of weekend and more of a get to know Michigan. Here's what we're all about. Have some fun. Eat some food. You know, more of a casual, because it can be stressful for the families and players too if they're getting this, you know, the recruiting pitch all weekend as opposed to just having a good time. So with that said, though, are there any players to watch out for as far as committing? Is there anyone's timelines lining up to something here in the end of July or in August as far as committing?
It's kind of hard to say.
Sure.
You got a lot of commits that are gonna be there. I'm not really sure on Josh Sanguinetti's timeline, the Fort Lauderdale safety. Or the same with Isaiah Foskey. I think some of those guys are kind of still playing things out.
Mm-hmm.
I would if there was anyone that I would look at, it would maybe be Mike Morris, the Florida State commit that might be coming. He's still considered tentative. He's a defensive end from Delray Beach. I think that he would be one that I would take a look at if he does end up coming. And I know he's leaning towards coming based off of my conversation with him. He would be one that I would think about. It's kind of hard to really say much when it comes to the 2020 class, particularly some of those guys. They're going to have two of the three commits there. Both Denver Warren and Andre Seldon are going to be there. Seldon is taking it upon himself to be the Chris Hinton of this class, where
okay. He's,
you know, really trying to push guys. I mean, you got guys like Khalil Mullings who have been who seemed like Michigan's no worse than top two. So I would maybe look at a guy like him, or maybe even like Bryce Mostella out of East Kentwood. But it's a little hard to tell because they don't really have that, you know, that type of visitors list, in my opinion, where it's a bunch of guys that are ready to make those decisions. I think a lot of the ones that were going to make these late summer, you know, pre-fall decisions were guys that they made sure to get up in at some time between March and June.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got a couple, you know, and be sure to check out Wolverine's Wire for more on the visits. You know, obviously we'll have our coverage too, but could be interesting, right? Like, it's always one of those things where you don't necessarily think someone's going to commit, and then they get on campus and it just speaks to them, and then things can happen. So certainly some dominoes could fall, but we did get a couple other recruiting questions, more toward the 2019 class. And I know Steve and I have remarked that we seem to get questions about a couple of these players every single week, but Carl Anderson says, what are Michigan's chances with Dax Hill since he's not officially visiting until the SMU game, so September, 16th? But he's committing, quote, soon. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I wrote on that a couple weeks ago, the day that he wrote that. I know Michigan's feeling, as I put it, tepidly optimistic about it. They seemed to feel, from what I had, what they had, the people that had shared this with me said that they had heard that there was something of a Michigan aura coming out of the opening. I don't know how true that is.
Mm-hmm.
I've spoken to a few people, and they kind of waffled on that. So I'm not really sure if that's exactly the case. But just given his top six that are remaining, you look up and down those, you know, those groups. Michigan has to be no worse than third, I would guess, top two. It's not like he hasn't been on campus before. So that's one of the things where I see a lot of freak out in my mentions. I have a mailbag that I have to do up today that I was trying to do yesterday. And that was probably a question I got three times, was specifically about that issue. It's like, oh, he's not coming for the barbecue and mm-hmm. he's going to commit soon. You know, he's doing his official visit. It's like, listen, he's doing his official visit to Michigan. I don't care if it's September or if it's November. If you're going to take an official visit, you know, to Michigan, especially when you're a Southern kid, there's interest.
Right.
So I don't know that, you know, if Oklahoma or Oklahoma State's the other real threat here. Oklahoma already has a couple linebackers committed at the position and everything. So I don't know if he looks at that and says, yeah, sure, I'll go and try to break that depth chart, or, you know, or whatever. But at the same time, Michigan might be one of the better fits for him when it comes to the teams that he has, you know, has left on his list. So I don't think it hurts that he isn't coming for the barbecue at all. Same reason I said about the nature of the barbecue. And it might be better to have him come for, and like a game like the SMU game. I'm kind of curious is where, how does Michigan treat their home games this year compared to last year? Because last year they had, throughout all their home games, they really only had two games in which they really went all out trying to have official visitors. They tried really hard to not have guys come, you know, for a one-off. Obviously, SMU isn't exactly a game in which you have circled on the calendar to be like, we need to get guys here to see this, you know. So that might mean that they're going to spend a little bit more time with him and everything like that as well. So regardless if he commits beforehand, the fact that he has that date locked in, it's still good for Michigan. You know, it matters, yes, to get someone's verbal commitment. But it really doesn't matter until they sign the dotted line, as we've all learned, you know, through all the trials and errors and everything that have come over the last several years. So even if he does commit somewhere else, Michigan's still sitting very well, considering he's going to make sure that he comes up and sees campus again, regardless.
Yeah. Yeah, and obviously it's one of those things, you know, things can always change, right? Like maybe he does because he's going to Oklahoma's event, which makes more sense because it's a lot closer to him. You know, it's a drive instead of a full trip from Oklahoma or from Tulsa specifically. But yeah, I mean, until he cancels the visit and actually commits somewhere else, because even if he commits somewhere else and doesn't cancel the visit, you know, it's still feasibly an open field. I mean, you know, you've seen that before where someone commits, they visit another school, they like it more, they think it's a better fit, and eventually they flip. I mean, you know, I think Michigan fans are pretty well versed on that possibility on both ends, because they've been able to flip people and they've also been flipped against before. So regardless, top five for Daxton Hill, Alabama, Michigan, Ohio State, Oklahoma, and Oklahoma State. Michigan has Sherrone Moore, who went to Oklahoma, recruiting him hard. And Chris Partridge is obviously the safeties coach that would be could feasibly be coaching him, is one of the top recruiters in the country right now. So we shall see. I mean, he's number 10 overall in the country, number one safety. Michigan has basically said you will be a four-year starting safety, or three-year if he wants to leave early. They're able to guarantee him a bit more playing time than I think some of those schools that are competing for his services. So, you know, keep your tabs on that. Tyler Patterson says, do you guys believe that there is a real optimism on flipping George Karlaftis from Purdue, even if Brohm stays at Purdue after the season? So to preface this for some of our listeners who maybe don't follow recruiting week in, week out, George Karlaftis, superstar, five-star, tight end. Let's see. I guess he's not technically a five-star in the composite, but he is a five-star in the eyes of 24/7, ranked 95th overall. Defensive end from West Lafayette. I believe his dad played for Purdue, but committed to Purdue. Committed to Purdue a decent while ago, it looks like in 2017. But Michigan is supposedly if he were to go somewhere else that wasn't Purdue, it would be Michigan. That's the reports that I think everyone has heard and what everyone has said. And so as far as Tyler's question, Jeff Brohm had a great first season at Purdue, a great first season. He was even linked to the Tennessee job. You know, ultimately Tennessee went with Jeremy Pruitt, mighty fine hire for them, despite all the chaos that was there. But, you know, you have to think, if Brohm wins seven or eight games with Purdue, you know, a school like LSU, a school like Kentucky, you know, they have Bob Stoops. I don't think they're thrilled with him. You know, say they don't have a good season, they have to be looking at what Brohm has done at Purdue and be thinking, this is someone we want to hire. Now, I don't know what Purdue's plan is. Are they going to keep bidding and raising their salary for him until he stays? But there is a good chance. I mean, it's one of those things where Purdue's in a weird spot with Karlaftis, because you have to think, if they do really well, if Purdue does really well this season, Brohm has a very high likelihood of departing and going elsewhere. If they don't do well, and Michigan, say, does do well, say Michigan wins 10 games, Purdue wins 4, you know, does Karlaftis look at this and say, well, you know, thanks Purdue, but I think I have a more desirable option up in Ann Arbor. So Isaiah, I guess, what are your thoughts on the possibility? Because it's been discussed, right? But it's one thing to have it be discussed. It's another thing to have it be a real possibility. Your thoughts on Karlaftis' possibility of flipping, and also how Brohm and Purdue, you know, where they sit as far as, like, do they need to win, like, between 6 and 8 games so that Brohm doesn't leave and Karlaftis doesn't leave? Or is Brohm, you know, do you think that he would stick around? I guess, where do you sit on that?
You know, I just wonder how much it is about winning when it comes to that, because, you like you mentioned, he's a legacy from Purdue. He lives in West Lafayette already. Those are already strong keys there for him. I was the first person to put in a crystal ball for him to Michigan last year after he visited. I'm guessing it was the barbecue at that point. Not sure the actual date, but he, you know, I spoke to him after that, and it was pretty clear that Michigan was the favorite, and then he turned around and committed to Purdue not too long after, and I think that was somewhat of a result of, at that time, he was only like a three-star, and Michigan had just gotten the commitments from both Stephen Heron and Christopher Hinton, and then it kind of seemed like he was doing that more of a, well, the writing's on the wall type thing. So I think now that his recruitment's blown up, it might be a little bit different. Like, so does he take a look at his recruitment and say, do I want to just go to the best possible chance to win a national championship? And say what you will about Michigan, and I know that Michigan's rivals fans certainly do, but Michigan obviously has a much better path to, I shouldn't say path, but better chance to get to a national championship game than Purdue. Purdue might have an easier path if they do really well, considering the Big Ten West. But the question is, are they ever going to get anywhere close to that, just given what they've been historically? And so I think it's really that. And, you know, I had a very brief conversation with him last week, and I asked him, like, is Michigan still on the table? And he was like, absolutely. So that says something, that he's still very much considering Michigan. Like you said, Michigan's definitely no worse than second here. If he isn't at Purdue, he's probably going to Michigan. So it is just going to be a question of how strong of a pull is it for him to keep the legacy going and to stay close to home. It's not that, you know, Ann Arbor is obviously not that far away, 4 hours. So it's just going to be a matter of what's his priority. And it seemed like his priority was more the legacy thing. But you also have to wonder how much was that shaped by, you know, the talent that was coming in alongside of him. And you know what? He might face the same issue, because if we don't know what Zach Harrison is going to do. So even though he's rose above Heron in the rankings and everything, and is viewed more favorably, I think, at this point than he was a year ago, it's you know, he still might have a couple guys ahead of him in the class. So I'm not really sure. When I connect with him, I'll certainly know a little bit more about his thinking as far as that's concerned. But I mean, that's a strong pull, especially when you know, like, for instance, I mean, I wasn't a student athlete or anything like that, but you know, I was going to Michigan no matter what. I was getting weirdly academically recruited by USC. And while that's a great option, I was going to Michigan. It was that simple. Even though Southern California was, you know, appealing enough, I ended up moving there the moment I graduated. But being a legacy and all that stuff means something, and it's hard to overtake that. But Michigan's clearly in consideration still, in the fact that he hasn't said, you know what, I'm a legacy, this is what I want to do for sure. And the fact that that hasn't happened yet pretty much tells you all you need to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's one of those things where he's had plenty of opportunity to just say, like, nope, you know, like he would have, if he was totally on board with Purdue, he would have said, hey, Michigan coaches, I appreciate it, but I don't really want to be contacted. Like we saw Wisconsin's Graham Mertz, who was probably like the most highly publicized, you know, every school thought they could flip him from going to Wisconsin. Well, he had that pretty assertive tweet where he was like, nope, I'm done. I'm done being recruited. It's going to be Wisconsin. Please stop contacting me. You know, and so, you know, to your point, Carl Aftis hasn't said that. You know, he hasn't come out. Now, maybe he has, but Michigan obviously has gotten a different message in that they to the point that they are still circling back and staying in the loop and contacting him, similar to they would a regular recruiting target, I would imagine. I don't know exactly what the numbers are like or things like that.
And he's open to it. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
He's quickly open to it. So.
Yeah, it's not like Michigan sent like 100 straight texts and gotten like two replies. Like it's been a communicative relationship in that, which suggests that he has not closed the door, but that he is leaning Purdue. He's committed to Purdue. I think, you know, if you're putting chips on the table, it'd probably say Purdue for now. But, you know, depending on what Purdue and what Michigan do, depending on what we're going to talk about next, what it kind of looks like as far as playing right away. Because I will say this, you know, if Carl Aftis wants to play a freshman year, he's more likely to do that at Purdue than he is at Michigan. But depending on how all those things shake out, you know, things could change. And speaking of kind of these openings, we got a question about, what did we get it about? Rob Lewis, what is the probability of Devin Bush entering the 2019 NFL draft? To answer it quickly, I'd say pretty high. You know, he looks very much like a modern NFL linebacker. You know, I made the case last week. If you missed the podcast, check that out on our iTunes page, that he is Michigan's best player right now. Entering this season, you know, you can agree or disagree, but the fact of the matter is he's very good, and both he and Kalik Hudson have garnered soft first round NFL draft discussions. And the reason why it's soft is because they only have 13 starts under their belt, so they're going to have to show it again and show maybe more consistency, slightly better coverage work. There's obstacles between point A and point B, but I think it's fairly high. I think he and Hudson and Isaiah, I'll be curious to hear your thoughts on all these players, but I would imagine, you know, LaVert Hill, David Long have got to be considered. Rashawn Gary got to be almost an obvious choice to leave early for the NFL draft. You know, and even someone like Zach Gentry, if he breaks out, you know, he could be gone. So, curious your thoughts on, you know, obviously, you know, Rob wanted to know about Devin Bush, but also on other players who could be early departures for the NFL.
I think you nailed it there pretty well. I think to add really in a way is with a lot of those players, like Rashawn Gary said not too long ago, like it's a failure for him if he doesn't get that national championship. And I don't know, looking at the schedule, if this is the year for sure. A lot has to, as much as that went wrong last year, has to go right this year for them to be able to get that. I think if they do make it to the college football playoff and do win the national championship, then I think all of the above that you just mentioned, as long as they all had decent years, are probably gone. But there could also be the pull to come back if they have a year more like 2016, where it's like, oh, they looked like one of the best teams. They just didn't quite get it done because the band can pretty much get right back together the next year because all the players you mentioned all have eligibility left beyond that. But a player like Bush, I think if he comes out and yes, I think he does have to build upon what he did last year. Just even though he is, like you said, like more of a modern linebacker, I think that I would guess that NFL scouts are still looking at him as being like 2 inches too short, which I don't think matters when it comes to his style of play. But I would imagine that he's going to have to for sure build upon last year to show like, hey, I can do this. I do agree. I have him as a top five player for Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm working on my rankings right now as far as players on the team, and I believe came in squarely at five, and the only reason why he wasn't higher was just literally, you know, lack of experience compared to some of them ahead of him. And so you look at players like him and Hudson, and Hudson, I think, is an interesting case because he wasn't a guy that we were talking about like this at all. You know, last year, even deep into the year, it was kind of more of an after-the-fact point where we all kind of looked back and said, wow, ended up tying Chase Winovich with 8 sacks and, you know, had that NCAA record tying, you know, game against Minnesota.
Yeah, 8 tackles for loss when they forgot to block him.
Yeah, so you look at all that kind of thing and it's like, okay, while you're really dealing with someone special here, you know, it makes people forget about Jabril Peppers to a degree. So really all of the above, because you just have so many guys, all those guys that were second-year guys last year, especially on the defensive side of the ball, that came in and made the defense look pretty similar to the 2016 squad. You have to imagine that they are able to take a step forward, and from what I've heard, they have, at least in the spring and everything like that, which has got to be really terrifying for any offenses that play Michigan this year. But it's really all of them, you know, save for a handful that probably need to show their work a little bit more. Guys like Josh Metellus, who I think Metellus was really gets a bad rap just because he and Kinnell had that had a couple bad lapses in coverage.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they weren't asked really to do that before. You know, they were they
also
were
first-year starters, too, you know.
Exactly. So I think maybe a guy, you know, a guy like Metellus, even if he has an amazing year, he's probably got, you know, got to show his work for another year just based off of what happened last year. I think questions would still, unless he's just unbelievable this year, but otherwise, almost that entire defense, as far as the guys who are eligible, could all go. I think that's a credit to what Don Brown has really built on that side of the ball. Offensively, it's a little bit different because really Patterson's the guy you're looking at mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Gentry, obviously, Gentry is an interesting case because when you look at him, he's like a bigger Mike Gesicki. Probably like, you know, bigger, maybe a little bit faster even. And that's, he's everything that you kind of thought that Tyrone Wheatley was going to be. So it does make things interesting for the sake of if he has a big year, he definitely, you know, could choose to not come back for his final year. And you know, in his case, I probably, if, you know, he has a big year and could get a high draft stock, I probably would go at that point. Especially with, there's so much talent in the tight end room for Michigan. I was doing my rankings looking at the tight ends particularly. It's like,
yeah, it's got like six guys.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, if Gentry wasn't there, if Tyrone Wheatley could stay healthy, I mean, he would be a guy, you know, that's kind of how you look at it. McCune, I think it's vastly underrated. McCune's a guy that I think probably is another needs to show his work for another year, just kind of based off of some of the, fair to him or not, some of the ball security issues from last year. Only one of those fumbles was his fault, in my opinion. But he'd be another guy that I would say is a lock to come back. But, I mean, imagine, like, if a guy like Chris Evans, who's put on weight, he's up to 217 now, which is just insane when you think about how tiny he looked when he reported to campus. Say he comes, like, you know, the 1-2 punch of him and Higdon, say they both eclipse 1,000 yards. Higdon's going to go at, regardless, because this is last year of eligibility, but Evans very well could, say they start getting, you know, he gets 1,000 yards rushing, and, you know, maybe they include him in the pass game, and he shows, you know, what he can do in space. We saw a tiny bit of that last year. That could really change things as far as that's concerned. You know, even on the offensive line, guys like Bredesen and Onwenu, they have a big year, more so Bredesen than Onwenu, since Onwenu was injured for half of last year.
Right.
But a guy like Bredesen, who's been there for a couple of years, if he comes and locks down his spot, you know, that's having, you know, 2.5 essentially years of, you know,
yeah, he'd be a safe pick. There. People would trust him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think he doesn't get nearly the amount of credit he deserves for doing the job that he's done where he's at either. So, I mean, that's a lifetime's worth of experience at the college level along the offensive line. We talked about before how at the offensive line, you really want guys that are coming in more as upperclassmen. You don't really want them starting until they're juniors. And he's been doing it since he's a freshman. So, if Ed Warner can really, you know, is working the magic that we've heard that he's been doing, and Bredesen, you know, is a part of a really great offensive line, there'd be no reason to not see him get that opportunity. So, I'm not predicting that we're necessarily going to see a mass exodus a la 2015 and 2017, but if they have a really good year this year, the cards are certainly set for that.
Right. My prediction, because I forgot to mention Patterson before. So my prediction is that Michigan loses five players early to the NFL draft. I think, personally, I think it's going to be Gary, Bush, Hudson, one of Hill and Long, or both of them and Patterson. So two out of those three, just you know, again, it's my hunch. I'm not looking at, you know, who projects where yet, because that's all going to change. A lot of players can improve or become draft prospects, you know, over the course of the season. So I predict that it's five. The Evans one is interesting because they are recruiting a lot of running backs. You know, they had three in the 2018 class. They have two in the 2019 class. You know, that's a lot of bodies. And I think, you know, offensive line, defensive line, they're always going to have high numbers. But that's something to keep an eye on, too. You know, because, like, the team, they aren't, like, saying, penciling people out or saying, oh, yeah, you'll be gone. But they do think about that stuff. And in this 19-member recruiting class with so many targets still on the board, you know, they are looking at this as a lot of players will either play their fifth season elsewhere, do a straight-up transfer, or, you know, and there are some statistical things. Like, I don't think it will be abnormal. That stuff happens every single year. Or they think a few of these players will leave early for the NFL draft. So something to keep in mind. One player that we also got asked about, Christopher Sheridan wanted to know, will Newsom actually be able to play again at any competitive level? I can't imagine so. And this is one of those things where, you know, every once in a while you hear, oh yeah, he's running. He's, you know, he's at practice today. You know, I don't know if he's done full pads yet.
No, yet.
Yeah. And that's a year, over a year and a half after his injury. You know, he spent 38 days in the hospital. You know, so this is something, you know, any sort of projection, you know, that he can play again is probably relatively speculative. I know he wants to, and he's making it his mission. It's a very inspiring effort. I mean, Isaiah, I guess I'll be curious to see what you have to say. My guess is that he will remain on the team, but it might not, like, he's not going to be your starting left tackle. I don't think you can figure him into the depth chart for this year or next year. Do you disagree?
Yeah, I just don't know until he actually,
right,
you know, gets the pads on and everything. I know he had said that they were just waiting on literally one thing to be cleared and he'd be good to go. It's a matter of if that happens, does he come back and look the same? Does he come back and look like he took a step back from, you know, having a year off?
Looks like he took 2 years off, yeah.
He's going to be a smarter player, which is a different thing. And you kind of think about how it is with, like, it's obviously a different sport entirely, different position entirely, but you think about how pitchers are when they get, you know, when they go down in the, you know, get up in the years and down to, you know, their career, the guys with high velocity like Justin Verlander have to kind of reinvent their game a little bit. And I would imagine that Newsom, who spent the last, you know, year and a half as a player coach, really all of last year, you know, because he wasn't even in consideration for doing anything, spent the entire year just learning and coaching and, you know, watching film and doing all of that kind of stuff. And so he had an opportunity that players don't usually get in that sense, where he really just got to sit back and soak in as much information. And for such a smart guy that he already is, that could be an asset to his game that could go significantly overlooked if he is able to suit back up, because he'll at least know technique-wise what he needs to do. Schematically, he knows what he needs to do. You know, all of that kind of stuff that usually you're learning on the fly. He'll come, you know, if he's able to actually get back onto the practice field and on the playing field, he'd actually be able to come at things from a level more so of, I know exactly what I need to do in order to succeed against no matter what's coming at me. And so I just have to implement that. So that's where I'm kind of curious. I'm not really interested in speculating if he'll actually play or not, because honestly, no one knows.
I don't think he knows.
They're just throwing stuff against the wall and saying, like, well, you know, here's, you know, how I feel about it. And until we get word either way, it's kind of hard to say. I think it's interesting, like you said, like, would he win a starting job, or would he be second string? That's the thing where it's curious, because that's the, you know, physical talent and mental talent is they're both equally useful, but they're such different things. And, you know, you're always looking at different players and why experience matters so much. I mean, yeah, you get better at football by playing football, and Newsom hasn't been able to do that. But knowing, looked at like Brandon Peters last year, for instance, Michigan clearly didn't trust him with, you know, the whole of the playbook yet. He didn't have it down enough yet to be able to execute it. On the other side, obviously it's, again, much different being an offensive lineman, but Newsom probably has, I would guess, the best mastery of the playbook than anyone else on the team.
Yeah, you'd think so. Yeah.
So that's got to count for something. Mm-hmm. So it's really, that's really, really difficult to project. But it would just be a matter of what would win out in that case. If he is actually able to play and play at a somewhat high level, would he be able to fend off a James Hudson or a Chuck Filiaga at left tackle, or, well, you know, just by the fact, sheer fact of his mental capacity, I wouldn't count it out. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, and if he doesn't, it certainly wasn't for a lack of effort, as you kind of allude to there. I mean, it's something they're all working toward, and, you know, he probably could have gotten a medical hardship scholarship a while ago, but Michigan has not gone that route, at least as far as I understand it. They've not gone that route, and that's a suggestion, I think, if you're reading kind of the situation, that they still think that there's a chance. You know, if they, you know, and maybe it comes, but if they are looking at this and thinking, you know, I just don't think it's going to happen, Grant, we're very sorry, then maybe they give him the medical hardship scholarship and let him pursue the rest of his life, you know, on full ride, right? Because that's how it goes. Austin Hatch had that same situation. So we'll see. But I think the fact that they haven't, kind of like Karlaftis, right? The fact they haven't come down and out and said, like, we don't think this is going to happen, you know, 2 years in, you know, they had a lot of times where they could have said, we don't think this is going to happen publicly. And they didn't. So that means that there's still a chance. But to the question, I would lean no, but I also think this fall camp might be interesting in the sense that they'll actually, if I'm not mistaken, he'll actually, you know, be out there with the pads and practicing, at least giving it a try. But obviously, you know,
we should at least have an answer on that in the coming days when we get to Big Ten Media Days, I would assume. You know, we
got to think someone's going to ask, right?
Yeah, and we should at least know if, like, is he cleared to, because if he's not cleared to go in pads by this fall, then I think you're looking at, it's going to be that much harder for him to get back in there, because then you're right. Going to end up getting a guy in, unless you're just banking on him being able to come back next year and replace potentially his starting Juwan Bushel-Beatty, you know, a guy whose eligibility is up no matter what. You know, who knows if he wins the job or not, but I think that's, like, really those are your only two options. Does he make it this year? If he's not able to go in pads this year, do you shut him down? Do you hold on to him? That's the really the big question, because he is, like you said, taking up a scholarship spot, and I mean I think they'll stick by him as long as, you know, he believes he can eventually do it.
Right.
At what point does that swim lane come up?
Mm-hmm.
Use a Jim Hackett term.
Oh, I didn't quite get that, but okay, I gotcha. Yeah, I mean, and so we'll see. You know, I think it, as you said, I'm sure someone will ask at Big Ten Media Days, and then in fall camp, I mean, you know, if he's practicing at fall camp, to the question, I think there's a good chance he does play competitively in some capacity. Now, you know, starter, maybe not, rotation lineman, maybe not, but you know, that's one thing. But if he's still not practicing and he's coming up on 2 years since he has played any ounce of football, then maybe you do kind of look at it and you say, well, you know, he certainly gave his best effort, but probably not going to happen. Anyway, switching gears, I think this is a funny question. Meryl Laggard on Twitter says, who will be the next, quote, Drevno? And what he means by that is a coach upon whom all blame is laid for misfortune at Michigan. So, you know, he says Pep, McElwain, Warner, someone on defense. I think the defense is safe. You know, if someone is out here criticizing Mike Zordich, Don Brown, Greg Madison, you know, that's kind of ludicrous. And then if also, you know, you could throw Al Washington and Chris Partridge because they're recruiting like fiends and their position groups are playing above average. You know, I mean, say what you will, but also Al Washington is new. But, you know, Partridge, he had the linebackers doing quite well. The safeties are not in a position where they're going to – I don't think anyone's looking at it and saying, you know, Michigan might be good, but their safeties are a serious concern. I think it's more of a specific plays concern Michigan fans about this defense. But so I think as far as the guy everyone blames, the scapegoat, I think it's going to be on offense. And I think, personally, I think Jay Harbaugh is probably safe, at least from the informed fans, because of how well he's recruiting and how well the running backs have done. So I think he's probably safe. I think Warner's safe for now. Now, if the offensive line is atrocious, maybe people look and say, like, what exactly are you doing? But I don't think he's going to get the same blame. So it comes down to McElwain. I think Sherwin Moore is safe, by the way. McElwain and Pep Hamilton, which is... To me, it's funny because those are like, you know, two people Michigan fans. Well, Michigan fans love to make fun of McElwain, and they were Pep was a big time scapegoat until that Amazon series came out, and then it seemed like people were like, oh, look at all he did behind the scenes that we didn't know about. So kind of polar opposites in interviews. I'm curious, Isaiah. I mean, you know, I would think Pep Hamilton probably gets it first if the passing game struggles, but maybe McElwain's more of an easy target. People like to make fun of him for looking like that shark guy, among other things. I don't know. Thought it was funny. Oh, we also got a question real quick that you can throw into this answer. Carl Anderson says, how long do you think Jim McElwain will stay? Is this a pit stop, or is the first offer that he gets his ticket out? Is he going to get offers? That's my question. And then, you know, what's his mindset heading into this job?
Well, first and foremost, well, I answer the McElwain thing first and both things with McElwain. Number one, if the wide receivers go out and get separation, catch passes, score touchdowns, you know, things that we didn't see happen last year, I think it will be very easy for McElwain to eschew any kind of blame because that's obviously been the big thing. As far as him getting attention, you know, outside, I mean, I think it's a near certainty unless he just bombs. I think he probably could have been the offensive coordinator somewhere if he wanted to hold out for a minute, but he jumped on the Michigan opportunity so fast, it kind of looked like it was going to be offensive coordinator, and it turns out wide receivers, and it sounds like Pep Hamilton's going to be more of the de facto guy there. So, by deduction at that point,
right,
it would be Pep Hamilton, which, you know, it deserved or not in a way, because Nick Baumgartner has been very quick to point this out constantly on social media. Jim Harbaugh's offense, you know, I don't know how much more have to stress that it's Jim Harbaugh's offense. He's the guy doing it. You know, it's not. It's very similar to what you see in, you know, in when you go to any school or NFL team that has a head coach that specializes on one side of the ball. You know, even at like Ohio State, like even though Urban was a cornerback when he played in college and everything like that. Clearly, he's an offensive-minded guy. Rich Rod, same deal, cornerback, offensive-minded guy. And, you know, it would be really difficult to look at, like, an Urban coach team or a Rich Rod coach team and then look at the offensive coordinator and say, hey, man, you're screwing up. Because it's not their scheme. They're just working underneath that. And I can attest, having watched Pep Hamilton coaches 10, 11-year-old son, however old he is, at the 7-on-7 last week.
Mm-hmm.
He can get a little fiery, man. It definitely was a different side. He gets on it. So he can be a lot more vocal than people realize, and he really gets involved in coaching and everything like that. You know, like we saw in the Amazon documentary, it was very, very similar. You saw a lot of emotion and everything there, but then you talk to him afterwards, and it's like, quiet, monotone, all of that. It's just you get the sense he doesn't care, but I think the sense is he doesn't care about the media or the headlines and all that. He cares about football.
Well, and go ahead.
Just because ultimately it just falls on Jim Harbaugh at that point. If the offense still isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing, and I do think he would end up being not even a scapegoat. I think people would be genuinely concerned at that point about what Jim Harbaugh is doing if the offense can't get significantly better this year.
Yeah, if they're outside the top 100 in a whole bunch of categories like they were this past year, I don't know exactly what happens, but I think that would be something where people do finally look at Harbaugh and say, this is on you. Because we've been saying this for a long time. You know, it's not Jim Harbaugh's offense like the team is Jim Harbaugh's team, you know, where he just kind of directs the coordinators and has, like, the overall mess. Like, this is, like, his plays and, like, his playbook and, like, his scheme and everything. I mean, this is all him. Yet, you know, and I think that's why he didn't name an offensive coordinator yet. I think we got a question we didn't get to answer last week about, like, will he name an offensive coordinator? I guess there's always a chance. I would think that if he was going to, he would have done that by now. You know, they said in the spring, you know, they're all kind of doing their thing, but it's really Jim Harbaugh's offense. And I think Harbaugh, you know, Drevno was, I think, overly hated, right? Like that one got kind of got out of control because it's kind of like a Nickelback situation where, like, yeah, probably not the best band. Maybe it's not the best, you know, the thing I want to listen to right now. But now it's like, if you don't despise Nickelback and throw them under the bus, you know, something's wrong with you. So I think mob mentality got a little bit there. But you know what? You know, regarding Drevno, I wasn't inside his brain or at his desk, but, like, I would get sick of that. And I don't think Harbaugh wants a situation where a coach, like, say Pep Hamilton does, like, an okay job this year. You know, they kind of underwhelmed. They're, like, 9-4 or whatever, 10-3 or something. And people are kind of upset at Pep Hamilton. Well, if he's offensive coordinator, it's going to be magnified. They're going to be like, this is your offense. You're the one who screwed this up. You know, you're terrible, this and that. Whereas if he's just the quarterback's coach, you know, they found that the offensive coordinator... isn't that a Bacon line? John U. Bacon says, like, the most hated person in Ann Arbor is the starting quarterback and the offensive coordinator. So,
yeah,
it's something of that nature. But regardless, you know, it's just one of those things. Like, you know, why name a person? Because it's just going to create a scapegoat. But I would think Hamilton, he's the one who's been around here another year. He is at the scrutinized position. I think he comes with the highest non-Don Brown paycheck right now. I think he's the only one at that level. So something to, you know, that'd be my pick.
So, yeah, and, you know, it's really when it comes down to it, these are all, with the exception of some of the younger guys that have more of a focus on recruiting, these are all very highly intelligent, very good coaches with a really good track record. And Tim Drevno included. Now, I do think that for whatever reason, it didn't fit, didn't work. You know, you hear Stephen Spinellis come out, you know, in the spring and say, which I've been parroting this all summer, but they're like, you know, he's out there trying to teach calculus to guys that only know algebra. And I think there's something to that, especially if you remember back to the fall when he had that analogy about pumping, you know, trying to pump a well and it wasn't giving out, just keep pumping and eventually it gives out. That did seem to be kind of what he was doing. And I think that works for some, you know, for when you're working with guys that have been playing college football for a few years. Like when he came to Michigan, it wasn't like the offensive line was very good when he got here. And it didn't end up being great in 2016, but it was definitely a step higher than it was when Brady Hoke was there. And it's a little bit different when you're dealing with, you know, second year Mason Cole, who was, you know, probably the smartest offensive lineman outside of Grant Newsom. You know, Kyle Kalis, you know, no matter what you say about him, I mean, yeah, he underachieved compared to his star ranking and everything, but, you know, guys like him and Eric Magnuson, you know, players who had at least played college football for a couple years before he arrived, that's a little bit different than when you look at last year. You had Mason as the sole returning player on the entire offensive line who had actual starting experience. And the only other upperclassman you had is Patrick Kugler, who had never been able to beat out anybody to the point where they slid Cram Glasgow inside back in 2015 from being an offensive tackle.
Right.
And then they slid Mason Cole inside from being left tackle the following year. So when you're working with pieces like that, and then you, on top of it, you're throwing in a bunch of second-year guys, and you're teaching NFL concepts and things. I know Drevno wasn't in the NFL quite as long because he spent his year at USC, but he did really good things that one year at USC. And it just seemed like he was kind of, in my opinion, probably just kind of stubborn with it and ended up just getting so much of that blame. Now, sure, the same thing could happen this upcoming year, you know, similar track record for Pep Hamilton, a little bit more obviously offensive coordinator experience, considering that he did it at Stanford after Jim Harbaugh left. He did it at Indianapolis. He then, you know, then went on to have a, you know, more reduced role with the Cleveland Browns. But there's certainly an opportunity to underachieve. But at the same time, I mean, the guys, they have very similar track records, McElwain as well. And I still don't really understand the disdain across the board. And when I talk to several Florida fans in my family and outside of my family, just like my friend Corinne is married to a Florida fan, and you talk to them about McElwain, and they absolutely do not like the guy.
Yeah.
But from the outside looking in, it still seems really weird to me, considering back-to-back SEC East championships.
Sure, yeah.
And last year, they were in a very similar boat to Michigan in that they had to replace a lot of pieces that, and you didn't really know what they were going to be able to do, especially like, you know, they're starting off the year, on the offensive side of the ball with Felipe Franks, who's the same class as Brandon Peters, and, you know, it's a bit different, but it's somewhat similar. And then you look at McElwain's track record, you know, as a coordinator and as a position coach and all of that. And I wrote about this back when I was at 24/7. It was, he only had one bad year in the bunch going into last year as a head coach, and that only year was when the Oakland, he was coaching, I believe, wide receivers for the Oakland Raiders. And that Oakland Raiders team was among the worst in the country. That Aaron Brooks, former New Orleans Saints quarterback, as their starter. And then he got injured, and they had some dude out there that I still haven't even heard of. And I wrote his name down a bunch of times in that piece. So that's any indication of what he was working with. But he's had an amazing track record. He was the first guy that came in and with Saban at Alabama, and you look at what he was able to do with guys like McElroy and A.J. McCarron and everything before he moved on to Colorado State, and then he turned Colorado State from a nothing to a something. And that's...
He did, yeah.
All very competitive. And, yeah, I'd imagine, like, just basically, you know, working with one position group. Maybe he'll dabble, you know, with the play calling and things like that, like Harbaugh's been doing for his entire career, trusting various inputs from various assistants. But nonetheless, I would imagine he would definitely be a guy that's going to get – he's going to get calls. I don't think Michigan is his forever home, if that's what the you know, questioner is asking, because it just really seems like this is just a stop to kind of prove his mettle before he goes and does bigger and better things, unless Pep Hamilton moves on and McElwain gets promoted. That would be the only way I could see him staying in Michigan for longer than 1 or 2 years, really.
Well, I would tend to agree. I mean, his track record, if he's able to do anything with the receivers, which everything I've heard suggests that is going to take place as far as the sophomore receivers stepping up, you know, I'm sure he'll get interest. I am curious, you know, the way he left Florida, it was not a performance. Well, it's not entirely performance. I know it's one of those things where it's always a little bit of performance, but he, you know, the whole death threats fiasco, some of the other stuff, I think that's going to keep him from being head coach. It's kind of like I would liken him a little bit to Brady Hoke, in the sense that people were worried that he was in over his head a little bit at Florida, and that maybe that wasn't the role for him. But regardless, you know, does have a track record. They all do, you know, and Drevno did as well. So I'll be, you know, I think, yeah, to decide where the scapegoat would be if there were going to be one. Because, again, if they're undefeated, no one's complaining about the assistant coaches. It just doesn't happen quite that way. It's only when the losses pile up that people are looking for some sort of outlet for their anger. But yeah. One last question here. This one comes from Shane Majewski, who says, what's the biggest reason for Michigan's 12-year drought for not beating a ranked team on the road? And I believe they are 0-16. In this particular stat since 2006, when they beat Notre Dame on the road. Is it culture, mindset? The program has had 3 different coaching changes that haven't been able to break through. My answer, I mean, Steve or Shane, you kind of said it right there. You know, they've had 3 different coaches. They haven't been very good. They haven't won a Big Ten title since 2004. They haven't finished the year as a top 5 team since 1999. You know, they are struggling. You know, to me, the road stat, because, I mean, ranked teams generally don't lose in their home stadiums, especially when it's probably, like with Penn State, it was a whiteout. With Wisconsin, game day was there. You know, a couple of years ago, Ohio State, it was the obviously the biggest crowd Ohio Stadium has ever had. I think Iowa might have set their record, too. They weren't even ranked. So it's just one of those things where, you know, it is tougher, and you have to be the better team to beat a ranked team on the road. And we saw in 2016, one play away from beating Iowa, one play away from beating Ohio State. So it's not like it's been this, like, you know, Michigan beats everybody on the planet at home and then goes on the road and loses some ducks. You know, there's been a couple situations, but, you know, they weren't beating a ranked team on the road in 2008, 2009, or 2010. They weren't doing that in 2014, and they weren't doing that in 2013. So in those 12 years, 5 of them, you know, the team wasn't even close to good enough to do that. And then, you know, from there, it's just kind of who you face. Well, they haven't beaten Ohio State very much lately. So that takes out a few opportunities. The Big Ten was pretty down in 2011. I don't even know. I guess they faced a ranked Michigan State team on the road. But I think that might have been the only ranked team they played all that season. So some of it's schedule, some of it's the team's not very good. Obviously, this question is pertinent to this season because they will be playing Notre Dame, Michigan State, and Ohio State on the road. You could also, perhaps, Northwestern could be ranked by the end of the season or at some point. You know, they finished the season ranked last year and they won 10 games, so they could be in that category as well. So, Isaiah, I kind of outlined my thoughts. I don't think it's like this curse. I don't think it's a culture situation. I think they approach it correctly. I just don't think they've had, you know, in 2016 was the one time I think they had a team that was good enough to beat ranked teams on the road. And they obviously were very, very close to pulling it off against Ohio State. but I don't think it's like some curse or some pitfall. I just think, you know, you look at all the numbers, it's been a while since Michigan was that team that goes, doesn't care where they're playing or who's cheering for whom, they're just going to beat you. Hasn't been that way in a while. So I guess, is there anything else to add to this streak in your eyes?
Yeah, I do think it is a culture thing to a degree, just because it's Michigan hasn't been Michigan since Bo Schembechler died. And ever since then, it was like Michigan lost true north until Harbaugh came back. And I do think that since Harbaugh's come back, they know where it is, but I don't think people realize like how much disarray Michigan had been in, especially going through multiple coaching changes over a relatively short period of time, which is not something that Michigan has really done very often. I mean, yeah, there was the Bo to Gary Moeller to Lloyd Carr, you know, based off of Gary Moeller's, I guess, antics, best way I can put it. But after Bo died, Michigan felt kind of rudderless in the sense that it just didn't have everything going for it, the support and everything. And I think that did trickle down to the football team, because one of the things that you learn pretty quickly when you cover the team is how not in a vacuum these players are. You know, like that they don't exist like, you know, you always hear the focus on, you know, like you should be spending your time focusing on beating Ohio State. Well, these are still kids in many ways that are, you know, trying to go to college and balancing that with, you know, playing on the biggest stage in football. And when you have as much fractions, as many fractions as Michigan has had over the years, you look at, you know, the entire Rich Rodriguez era. And that entire time, you know, you had basically a revolt from the Letterman and the alumni base as far as those who had played. You know, people weren't getting behind them, and you had, you know, Stan Edwards coming out and saying a bunch of weird things. You had Braylon Edwards, not to single out the Edwards family, but, you know, Braylon going on Monday Night Football and saying that he was an alum of Lloyd Carr's Michigan. And they just didn't have that support in that sense. And while that doesn't translate necessarily directly to on the field, it does permeate the program. It has it where people aren't on the same page. And then you had the same kind of thing happening in many ways when Brady Hoke was at Michigan. Not from that exact perspective. You know, he pretty much had galvanized all the groups of people who weren't, you know, who weren't on board with Rich Rodriguez and everything. But at the same time, there you hear of things like when I talked to Channing Stribling over a year ago, where he says there was some segregation in the locker room. And, you know, they were definitely fractured by not only, you know, offensive units, defensive units, but also by skin color. And it's kind of hard to win games when you're not, that's clearly not a team at that point. You know, that's just a bunch of guys playing a bunch of roles. And that's where when Jim Harbaugh came in, he seemed to be able to eradicate that, bring everybody together. We heard plenty of talks about, you know, all the guys getting on group chats and stuff like that, where they weren't like that before Harbaugh arrived. They got a lot closer and they started playing a lot better as a team. So now you're starting to get into this a little bit more of where the culture isn't responsible as much for the last couple of years, as much as it is schematic, as much as it is, I think, a bit recruiting. Some of those Hoke classes didn't end up paying out as much as highly as they were ranked. So I think there was a little bit of disparity, and I do think that, and I said this on TV, and I'm surprised I didn't get anyone writing me letters about this, but I do think sometimes the Michigan arrogance comes to play. Even though Michigan hasn't been Michigan since 2006, I do think there's still something of an entitlement mentality. You see it from fans all the time, in the sense that, you know, the expectations are 12-0 every year, expected to win every single game, even games that they shouldn't win, especially in retrospect. And I think that sometimes does trickle down to the team. I think sometimes you do get it where in very much in particular, you look at Michigan State, you know, games against Michigan State, and they play against Michigan State, and I feel like they all know, like, hey, we're all 4 and 5 stars. Michigan State's a bunch of 3 stars with a 4-star or 2 peppered in. And they just don't think that they have to do as much in order to win. That could be some conjecture on my part, but that does seem to be kind of what happens, especially you go on the road, like that Iowa game. They weren't ranked, like you mentioned, but, Michigan, I think, was well aware of where their standing was. They were atop of the college football world. They were about to be ranked number 2 going into that game based off the couple teams that lost in the immediacy.
I think they were number 2, and they had the chance to be number 1.
That might be right.
Yeah.
And so you have that, you know, that type of thing, and then they underachieved at that point. But they aren't far off, like you said. I mean, they were literally a couple inches away from beating Ohio State. You know, and there was some questionable calls that led to them even being in that spot in the fourth quarter. So, they basically had that game won. They put on, you know, back in 2015, they did a really nice job against Utah in Harbaugh's first game with a quarterback that was coming in and trying to learn a system and a whole team trying to learn a system, and they still put forth a really good effort. So I think if they lose all 3 of those games this year, then I think it's a little bit problematic because I think they've been building to this, but I think it takes a long time to reestablish a culture. And as we all, I think, took a look at year 1 Jim Harbaugh in 2015 and thought 10-3 after hearing all offseason that Michigan would be lucky to make a bowl game and thought, all right, well, off to the races, this is just what Harbaugh does. Well, I think it's a little bit harder when you're that, especially compared to the NFL, where you do have kind of a set talent level. Some teams are obviously much better than others. But, you know, you essentially have a baseline for the talent level, which is they're all professionals. At the college level, you're dealing with a lot of other stuff. You're dealing with boosters. You're dealing with factions. You're dealing with alumni, you know, both on the football side, not on the football side. You're trying to build, a roster in your image and everything like that. And I think it takes a little bit longer to build a program. That's why there's so many dumb arguments that you always hear about, like Jim Harbaugh hasn't won with his own quarterback and all of this kind of nonsensical rhetoric. But we're heading into year 4, so now we're, I think, considering last year, the way it went, you and I both predicted double-digit win seasons, but we also didn't predict that they'd be on their third-string quarterback in pivotal stretches down at the end of the season. So, I mean, if everything goes to plan, I mean, they should win at least one of those 3, if not 2 or 3 of them. So, but it takes a lot of groundwork to get to this point.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It does. And again, you know, if they can complete, because like I think last year, it's like they led Wisconsin at, you know, in the second half. And they led... Who else were they on the road? I guess Penn State wasn't really that close. But, you know, that Wisconsin team, a lot of people think they should have been in the college football playoff. And they were there, you know, with a backup quarterback and the young team and all. But they just didn't have the juice to get it done. Conventional wisdom would suggest with 17 returning starters and the insert of a 5-star quarterback and collective growth at pretty much every position, save for maybe the nose tackle position held by Mo Hurst, you know, this team will be better. And they will walk into a couple of these arenas, a couple of these stadiums with more of a shot at winning than they have had during much of this 12-year stretch. So, you know, it's all conjecture. Football season is coming. Big Ten Media Days are next week. And then the week after that, practices begin. And so we'll obviously keep it going. We'll have more on, you know, barbecue at the big house and the aftermath, more on recruiting, more on football, and then eventually basketball will become relevant again. So it should be a good couple months here. Hopefully everyone enjoys this like last little stretch before it's football nonstop. Anyway, thank you so much to Isaiah Hull of Wolverines Wire for coming on the podcast. I'm Zach Shaw. Check out all of our stories at michigan.247sports.com, themichiganinsider.com. Steve Lorenz will be back in the podcast next week. But until then, hope you had fun. Hope you learned something. And we'll see you next time.